Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Today on The Breakdown, he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now Goodwin Liu sits on the California Supreme Court.
That's right. He was named to the court by Governor Jerry Brown after Republicans blocked Liu's nomination to the federal bench. We'll be talking with him about what he learned working with Justice Ginsburg and his thoughts on the battle to replace her. And boy, Marisa, a week ago, of course, none of this had happened. The justice died on Friday, the eve of Rosh Hashanah, stunned everybody and has really upended the 2020 political election in a lot of ways. And it's going to be a big moment as this confirmation gets underway for both of our senators, Senator Feinstein, who chairs Judiciary, Kamala Harris, of course, who's also running for vice president. What are your thoughts? I know you've begun doing some reporting about Senator Feinstein. There are some concerns about her. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is really, you know, a study in contrast. For as much as sort of, you know, grief that sometimes Kamala gets from the left about not being progressive enough, you know, she is very much a different mold than Dianne Feinstein, who I think harkens back, quite frankly, to another era in a lot of ways. And so we're seeing some concern. Politico had a story. I mean, I want to be clear. A lot of people who have concerns are not willing to say them on the record, right? But there is questions
about... She's a powerful senator.
Yeah, and there's questions about whether she's up to the job. I mean, we did see during the Kavanaugh hearings, I think some people were disappointed by kind of the tenor of her questions. Obviously, Kamala Harris has made a name for herself with her prosecutorial kind of questioning of witnesses, whether they be confirmation hearings or otherwise. So I do think that Dianne Feinstein there is some concern within the Democratic caucus. I mean, the truth is, nothing she can do is likely going to hold up this nomination if the Republicans want to get it through. But I do think if Biden and Harris win and they retake the Senate, there will be questions. There are already questions about whether, you know, she's the right person to be chairing that committee because she is the ranking member on Judiciary.
Yeah,
and that was
a big
part of her reelection argument, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Was
I have the authority
of
seniority, exactly. But, you know, in some ways it reflects this larger cleavage within the Democratic Party where you have, you know, Bernie Sanders and AOC and others really pushing for fundamental changes, Dianne Feinstein, Joe Biden, and to a certain extent, Kamala Harris, really more about evolution than revolution. And so I think some of that is going to play out. There are people that want, for example, Senator Feinstein to come out for expanding the court. And, you know, a lot of people say this is not the time for that. We need to get through to the election. And then if Democrats take over, there'll be plenty of time to talk about that. Kamala Harris, boy, she is really in a spot. Of course, she will be likely called away from the campaign. She's got a debate with Mike Pence, the vice president, on October 7th. She's got a lot on her plate. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how she navigates these hearings because I'm not sure she's going to take the same kind of combative role that she played, say, in the Kavanaugh hearings, because that's a high-stakes gamble for her to do that.
It is. I mean, I wouldn't expect her to be too different from the Kamala Harris we know, but I think you're right. She may temper some of those criticisms. It might be a little bit different. I mean, she is in a different stage running for vice president than she would be as just the junior senator from a safely blue state. But I don't expect her to pull all her punches for sure. And I mean, again, like you said, this is going to depend on who the nominee is. I think Democrats at this point are really trying to focus on the process and saying, regardless of who it is, we want, you know, this is really hypocritical given what happened in 2016 with Merrick Garland. And a lot of questions about whether the filibuster is breathing its last breath. We'll get into that with our guest, I think, after the break. But yeah, I think whatever happens, they will be two to watch in that committee room.
Yeah. We do have an election coming up, and it's going to be sort of in some ways an election season more than election day. Ballots will be going out to all registered voters in California. And there was a Berkeley IGS poll out this week that we've talked about on the air, on the radio, and online this week. And Marisa, they looked at four ballot measures in particular, Prop 22, the Uber-Lyft measure, Prop 15 on property taxes. Prop 16, affirmative action, and 21 on rent control. And what struck me was the high percentage of voters who are still undecided on these issues. And I think in part that's because, you know, some of these are somewhat complicated and, you know, people haven't maybe studied them yet. But there's so much competition for voters' time with the pandemic and the wildfires and, you know, now the Supreme Court. It's going to be tough, I think, for these campaigns to break through.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that this is often an issue when we have this many ballot measures, and they are complicated questions often that voters are being asked to kind of become experts on very quickly. I think the sort of broader political tenor is definitely making it more challenging to break through. And the fact that, again, like, these are not simple things, right? Talk about Prop 15, property taxes. Will it affect small businesses and farms? Won't it? You know, a lot of these questions are really interesting. I will say on Prop 16, affirmative action, I think it'll be fascinating to see how the results of an audit this week that really found favoritism in some of the decisions in terms of who got into a handful of the UCs, whether that is something that the campaign can really use to show voters who are so largely undecided that this is an issue that matters, you know, that maybe there is affirmative action for some people if you're wealthy enough and have the connections.
Yeah, there's all kinds of affirmative action. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by California Supreme Court Justice Goodwin Liu. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. And our guest today is Goodwin Liu. He's an associate justice of the California Supreme Court, appointed in 2011 by then-Governor Jerry Brown. He's also clerked for the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Liu, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
No, you're joining us from Washington, D.C. You are back there along with many of her former clerks to honor her. What was it like yesterday when there was the ceremony at the Supreme Court, Chief Justice John Roberts speaking? And what was it like for you personally and for, you know, for all the clerks who were back there?
It was an incredibly solemn occasion. It was a historic day. It was a very bright and sunny fall day in Washington, D.C. All the clerks stood in formation across the front plaza of the court. That was a very powerful image of the part of the tremendous legacy that Justice Ginsburg left. I think in each one of our hearts, we hold not only her memory and all the wonderful things that she did for us personally, but also her overall vision of the law and the better America that she wanted.
So you graduated from Yale Law School in 1998, and then you clerked for Justice Ginsburg from 2000 to 2001. Can you talk broadly about, I mean, we want to get into maybe some of the cases, but what did you learn from her as a jurist? I mean, what was the what's the lessons that have stuck with you?
Well, you know, as a jurist, Justice Ginsburg is a meticulous writer and editor. She is someone who pays attention to every word, every comma, every phrase. One day I happened to go into her office to get a case file, and inside that file was an internal memo that a law clerk had written to her. These are just, you know, memos that go from us to her, and they don't get published or circulated anywhere else. I happened to notice that on this memo were these faint pencil marks, catching little typos and missing commas and the like. And this was a bit of a surprise to me because she never returned these memos to us. But this was just her way of demanding perfection in whatever was before her eyes. And, you know, it was a great sort of lesson that, you know, you should strive for eliminating every error because it's just a speed bump to reading your argument or your analysis. And she just modeled that in everything she did.
One of the cases that came up while you were a clerk was a real historic one, Bush v. Gore, which ultimately settled the 2000 presidential election. You were a clerk then. How did she approach that case?
She approached that case the way she approached every case, which is what is so remarkable, because obviously that was a very controversial, high-temperature case. But she approached it with the sort of cool, calm, and collected manner that she brings to everything. She was a paragon of just even temperament and collegiality, which I must say, as I've, you know, myself and now being a judge and experiencing, you know, what it's like to disagree with your colleagues on things that matter to you, you know, that was really, again, just a model for all of us as to how to comport oneself in the face of a very difficult situation.
Yeah, I noticed reading about when you came to the Supreme Court that you modeled some of that behavior with folks, you know, that she had that relationship with Scalia everybody talks about. I know you enjoy hanging out with your colleagues outside of the court as well sometimes.
Right, that's right.
I want to ask a quick follow. You know, that case had such, as you, it was like political dynamite. And, you know, there's a sense sometimes from the outside that justices have a preconceived notion of how they're going to rule based on their own personal views or even their personal politics. I mean, it was no secret, I think, how Justice Ginsburg felt about, you know, people like, you know, Democrats versus Republicans. I don't want to read too much into it, but as someone who's been on the inside, how would you push back on that idea?
Well, I mean, I think it's unfortunate, of course, that so many cases, not just Bush versus Gore, but just many cases in the Supreme Court end up 5-4 along some kind of predictable political axis. But I would just say, though, that I think one always has to be very careful about this, to actually read opinions and look at legal arguments. You know, I don't think the law can really be understood as just politics in some other name. You really have to look at things carefully because you won't be able to understand why there are some so-called surprise votes cast every so often. I mean, this past term at the U.S. Supreme Court, we saw a number of what you might think of as crossover votes. And, you know, we always hail those when they occur. But if you look a little deeper into people's methodological approaches to the law or how they've actually understood the legal issues, you might, you know, gain a deep understanding of how judges actually approach cases. And yes, of course, there's going to be plenty of 5-4 decisions, but that is not, you know, always a predetermined thing.
I'm curious, I know you kept in touch with Justice Ginsburg and others in D.C., you guys obviously who are around there this week. And it does feel like the last few years the courts have become even more political than they were during that 2000 decision. There is such a partisan fight over whether there should even be a nomination and confirmation before this election. I'm curious how you feel about that and how you think Justice Ginsburg viewed these questions. Like, are these political fights delegitimizing the courts in some way?
You know, I think judges of all stripes tried their level best to comport themselves as judges and take the politics out of it. You know, Justice Ginsburg herself, I don't think was, you know, not fairly described as a political person. She actually was a very consistent person throughout her career, regardless of, you know, what party was in power or whatever. She had a very strong constitutional vision. And I say it's a constitutional vision, not a political vision, but she had a constitutional vision about what the promise of equality meant, not just for women, by the way, but for racial minorities, for people with disabilities, for all kinds of people in this country. And I think she, you know, some people have asked me, do you think she got more liberal, you know, as time went by, because she was kind of, you know, branded a moderate when she first began. And my answer to that is, I don't think so. I think she was, she's been the same. If you go and read her confirmation hearing testimony from 1993, she is the exact same person then as she was just this year. So I think if anything, the world has changed around her a little bit. Of course, polarization, political polarization is very bad in this country. But she was above it in a certain way. You know, she had a certain idea about the Constitution, and that through thick or thin was her guide.
Well, and so many people were fascinated by her friendship, and it seemed to be a real friendship with Antonin Scalia, who, you know, they would disagree vehemently, you know, from the bench sometimes in her dissents or his dissents. And I think it's surprising to so many people that you could do that at work and then go have a beer or go ride on an elephant, you know, in India or Egypt, wherever they were in that iconic photograph. Yeah. You know, is that just them personally, or is there something bigger, a bigger lesson there about courts?
Well, that was very real. I mean, that was not for show. The two of them really enjoyed each other and were deeply affectionate, you know, in their friendship. I think it reflects the fact that neither of them, despite the largeness of their personalities and what they stood for in the law, neither of them took themselves personally with undue seriousness. You know, they understood that, you know, you can certainly, you know, have these beliefs and have contrasting visions of how to interpret the Constitution, but at the end of the day, you know, at the more human level, they were able to see each other as people, both of whom were operating in good faith, doing their best to do their important work.
So, as we alluded to at the top, I mean, you were sort of the victim of some of these partisan squabbles, and I do want to talk about that. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts on whether Congress should take this up before the election. Is that something, you know, are there things besides just political considerations, I guess, that Congress should be considering?
Well, that's really not for me to say. I think that all the arguments are being aired right now, and, you know, the most important considerations have to do with the overall structure of government and the long-term implications of what, I mean, this is one controversy we're living in right now, but obviously it's going to have ramifications for the structure of government for years to come.
I want to ask about your family, Justice Liu. Your parents were both immigrants from Taiwan. You were born in Georgia. I think lived briefly maybe in Florida. They were physicians. And you ultimately moved to Sacramento when I think you were about 7 years old. What do you remember about, you know, living in the South?
It's so interesting, Scott. I, several years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago now, happened to be in Georgia for a speaking event in Atlanta. And I had a few hours to kill one afternoon, and I rented a car, actually, and decided to go visit my birthplace, which was Augusta, Georgia, about 2 hours to the east. I had never been there, actually, as an adult. And it was really interesting and eye-opening because, you know, Augusta's a small, still a smallish town. And as an adult now, and having been a scholar and a student of when I was, you know, before a judge, I was a scholar of education law, I came to understand that the public schools in Augusta, Georgia, Richmond County, were segregated. And they were segregated for quite some time, even after Brown versus Board of Education. The first court order that began the desegregation of the Augusta public schools did not occur until, I think, after I was born in 1970. And so I always thought about, you know, how different my life would have been had we stayed there. My dad had been stationed there for some medical training, and it was not uncommon for immigrants like my parents to end up in some pretty out-of-the-way places where they were underserved in terms of health needs. And so we left there. We then moved to an even smaller town, I think, in Florida called Clewiston, which you would never have heard of except It's the setting for Zora Neale Hurston's book, Their Eyes Were Watching God. It's the area right under south of Lake Okeechobee near Belgrade. And Belgrade was what we considered the big city, you know, and had 15,000 people compared to the town, which had 5,000 at the time. And, you know, that was actually how I grew up. Small town America, you know, one main street, football on Fridays, although I was too young to really understand that at the time. And my parents in that setting learned, you know, for lack of a better word, how to assimilate to America. I mean, they were ultra minorities, you might say, because they're sort of like a minority of one, you know, one or two. It's not like they had a community in these places. And so my parents, always very thankful for the opportunities that they got in this country, kind of deeply believed in the system and getting along and, you know, acculturating us basically to the mores of this country.
You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we've been talking with California Supreme Court Justice Goodwin Liu. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. So, Justice Liu, I'm curious then, having that experience in a small town in Florida and then coming to Sacramento, I mean, did you feel American growing up? Were you very aware of your parents' immigrant status? I think I read somewhere that they didn't really teach you English until you went to kindergarten because they didn't want you to have an accent. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, like many immigrants, actually, that is the case, yeah. Although if you ask the linguists, they will tell you that doesn't really matter. But in any case, yes, of course, they thought these kinds of things. And that's an indication of, again, like how solicitous they were of trying to make sure that, you know, we were properly acculturated to our environment. But yes, absolutely. I felt both things. I felt deeply American because this is the only country I've ever known. But I also felt that duality of being, you know, in some ways an outsider, you know, because there's this great picture actually that captures this. When I was a little kid, maybe about 6 or 7 years old, I joined the Cub Scouts. And there's this picture of me wearing the Cub Scout uniform, the shirt, the handkerchief around my neck, and I got the little cap on. And then my bottoms are these horrible plaid pants with knee patches. And it just, you know, it just shows you, you know, the top of that I was wearing was very regulation and the bottom was clearly homemade, right? and that kind of epitomizes, you know, my upbringing, living in both worlds, as it were. And I think, you know, there's many, many analogs to this for lots of people in this country who have felt that duality, the insider-outsider duality. You can go all the way back to, you know, what W.E.B. Du Bois called, you know, double consciousness when he described the experiences of Black people in America. And I'm not going to compare my experience directly to that, but I'm just saying that there's a lot of this kind of feeling that people have. They love this country so much, as do I, but they're also acutely aware that not everyone is always treated as a full member.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk about the importance of diversity on the bench, and that's part of it, isn't it? That your own experience helps you understand some of the people and the cases that come before you in a way that's different than the justice or judge sitting next to you.
Absolutely. And I think that that diversity encompasses a very, very broad range of characteristics, of which I think, of course, ethnicity and background is one. But just thinking about our court, for example, I mean, for having only 7 seats, I would say we have a wonderfully diverse bench. We have, you know, a variety of professional experiences. You know, Justice Cuellar and I are former scholars. We have Justice Groban, who was a practicing lawyer and then worked in government. Justice Kruger was an appellate lawyer for a number of years. Our Chief Justice, an amazing person, was a prosecutor and then worked in government and worked her way up the court system. Justice Corrigan, also a prosecutor, worked her way up the court system. And then Justice Chin, who recently retired, who contributed many, many years to our court, was a practicing lawyer for a number of years, and then also moved his way up the bench. And so I think it's, you know, that is so enriching. And I've learned so much from my colleagues. And that really is the way it's supposed to be.
So we can't let you go without talking about that bruising confirmation battle under President Obama. I believe this was 2011. You were nominated to the Ninth Circuit of Appeals. At the time, there were no Asian American judges at the appeals court level, I think, in the entire nation. And you basically got filibustered. They couldn't get the votes in the Senate. Republicans blocked and even a consideration of the nomination. How did you leave that feeling, and has it impacted your work and life since?
Well, you know, of course, anybody who goes through something like that feels disappointed, and I certainly felt disappointed. I understood at some point in the process that there were lots of forces beyond my control, and I did not take it personally. Certainly, you know, I don't claim to have a perfect record or a perfect life, and there's many things that people could, criticize or target you for if that's what they want to do. But I'm proud of my life, and I'm proud of the things that I've worked on in my life. And I think overall, I was able to communicate that in the process and didn't walk back from that. So I felt proud of that. I'll tell you a little story, which is that my disappointment was kind of short-lived because I was in Washington the day of the filibuster, and then it happened. I flew back home that very night. It was a Thursday, and then I was very disappointed. Of course, the next day, Friday, I was walking into my office at UC Berkeley where I was teaching. And before I could even turn the handle to my door, the phone was ringing. I pick up the phone, and it is my future colleague, Josh Groban.
Who was the Governor Brown's appointment secretary, legal secretary.
Who then said, he says to me on a phone call, "I see your fortunes have changed. would you be interested in a conversation with Governor Brown about the California Supreme Court?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'd be interested in just about anything right now." And so,
not a bad consolation prize.
From there, Governor Brown then called me personally a few minutes later, and he said, "You want to talk? Great. Meet me in my Oakland office at 1 p.m. today." And so, you know, literally, I've never experienced such a swift change of fortune that, you know, the previous day I was languishing in the well of the Senate, you know, in a filibuster.
Yeah.
A few hours later, I was sitting with Governor Brown.
Yeah, we've got just a short time left, but I do want to ask you, if Wikipedia is to be believed, you're turning 50 next month, October. What are you thinking?
No,
what are you?
are you
going to be reflective about that? Obviously, you've accomplished a great deal, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, I have been reflective. I think a lot of my peers are turning 50. I'm thankful for my health. I'm thankful for two wonderful children. I think as we get older, actually, I was just talking to a colleague about this yesterday. The things that matter in life come into greater focus. Your family, your children, your parents. I mean, my parents have lived a long life. They're over 80 years old now. And all of those things, I think, matter greatly to me, and I'm balancing them with my career.
All right. Justice Goodwin-Liu, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's been a very difficult time for you with the death of Justice Ginsburg. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Erica Aguilar, and Jonathan Blakely. I'm Marisa Lagos. You can find me on Twitter at @mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm @ScottSchaefer. Thanks so much for listening.
Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.